Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. What was your favorite game as a kid? Do you have memories of running around, making stuff up, building things and tearing them down? And are today's kids getting the same kind of play opportunities? A growing body of research points to the importance of play in children's lives. It helps develop critical cognitive, physical, and social skills and is essential for a child's emotional well-being. Yet, as life becomes more complicated for families and schools are pressured to measure academic achievement, even for their youngest students, and technology is more readily available, free time for play is on the decline. During this hour, we'll explore the value of play with three participants in this weekend's Conference on Play in Philadelphia. It's all part of the city's Declaration of Play. Joining us to talk all about play are clinical child psychologist Marjorie Bosk and Smith Memorial Playground Program Director Naomi Roberson. Let's say hi to both of you first. You're in studio.
Good morning.
Good morning. And in a little while, we'll hear from Susan Lynn. She is from the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. So, Naomi, let me start with you.
Yes.
What did you play as a kid?
Oh, so many things. I grew up in the city in New York, and we had not a lot of play space, not a lot of green space, but we had wonderful parks, as a lot of people know. So we would always go to the parks and kind of play in the grass. I loved to skate, so I would always skate on the sidewalks. And my favorite thing about skating in the, on the sidewalks was the little bumps on the sidewalks.
Yes.
That was my favorite part about that. We also played on the jungle gyms and in different playgrounds around the city. So I also had a very active imagination as a child, so I loved to play teacher and got into a lot of trouble with my mother because I liked to write on the walls with my chalk.
Oh.
So those are the kind of the things that I played as a child.
And Marjorie Bosk, what did you play?
Very similarly to Naomi, I grew up in urban Baltimore, and I played outside. I was the group of kids growing up in the 50s and 60s where moms kind of locked the door and said, kids, go play, come back for dinner, in time to set the table, but not before. And we played as a neighborhood. We played with kids. We ran in the street. We played ball. We built forts. I think one of my most favorite play memories is building an igloo Eskimo house during a blizzard, which was unheard of in Baltimore. It took 3 days. My mother was worried about hypothermia, but it was the most intense, focused work play I have ever done. It was magical.
And of course, if our listeners have questions or observations about play, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. I already have a lot of questions when you both were talking. That very much sounds like my childhood, too. But it seems like kids today don't have that kind of freedom to be out and about. You said your mother sent you out and said, go play. Are kids still allowed to do that now?
I think a lot of that has a lot to do with parental fear around what's outside, the unknown. So we talk a lot at Smith when we go out and do workshops or talk about play, about parental fear and about no matter socioeconomic backgrounds or where you live within the city or outside of the city, parents always have an ingrained fear of some danger coming to their children, whether it's the big boogeyman in the black van or some type of gun violence in their neighborhoods. So I think a lot of that does have to do with parental fear of children being outside until the streetlights come on, like we used to do long ago. So I think that that is one piece of it. I also think that there's a lot of parental guilt with having to work all the time for whatever reasons and wanting to spend money on your children as opposed to letting them play freely. I think there's just a lot of pressure for parents to either buy their children things or to keep them in very structured activities that don't allow for free play.
I would like to add that I think that parents are under enormous pressure that Naomi referenced, and I agree with all the points that Naomi made. I'd like to add that our culture And I think parents are victims of this just as children are the object of a culture that has created enormous competition and pressure, and the values that if you do it sooner and faster and earlier, your kids are going to achieve more and be better. And we know from decades, century of very good research that it is actually the opposite that is the case. But everything that I say moving forward, I would really like to just underline that we are not blaming parents. Parents are under the same pressures.
How do you define play? There are a lot of different ways to play. What is the kind of play that you would like to see kids do more of? Let's start with you, Marjorie. And then.
Okay. I think when we talk about play, we're talking about child-initiated free play, play that is freely chosen, personally directed, and intrinsically motivated. It is.
What does that mean?
It comes from the child. The child knows what he or she wants to do and is allowed, you know, within the bounds of safety, to be able to explore and play and not be directed and taught and pressured that they're able to use very generic toys or cardboard boxes, not toys that already have scripts attached to them.
Naomi?
Yes.
And exactly. at what age do kids start to play? And do they know how to do this? Is it in them, to speak?
Play is intrinsically in a child. Children begin to play when they come out of the womb. they know. They understand. They get it. And that's their way of developing and learning different developmental skills and different learning aspects and social behaviors. And, you know, you see even newborns, you see them kind of looking around and exploring their, you know, their environment. And for them, that's their way of developing and learning. So play happens immediately. It happens as soon as they're out of whatever they're coming out of. So I think that play is just intrinsic in children,
and they can do it.
They can do it on their own. We don't need to assist them. I think that it's extremely important for adults to be involved in children's play, but I also think that it's even more important to allow the children to direct their play.
And there is nothing, I believe as a parent and as a psychologist who works with children, there is nothing more powerful between a child and a parent than for a parent to join in the play that a child, he or herself, is directed. It is probably the most efficient way to emotionally connect and know where your child is at.
We're talking about the value of play and what kids can learn from play. We're joined here in the studio by Marjorie Bosk. She is a clinical child psychologist, and also Naomi Robertson. She is the program director at Smith Memorial Playground in Philadelphia's Fairmount Park. I'm sure many of our listeners have been there. Now, what kind of skills do kids learn during the kind of play that you describe?
There are so many. We at Smith do workshops with parents and various parent groups and talk about the different developmental skills that children are developing through play. So, you know, when you see a 2-year-old going playing with puzzles or playing with blocks, they're learning spatial development, and they're learning how to place things and where to place things. Lots of little children like to pinch things or play with tape or play with rice. So that's their fine gross motor skills. Social norms when playing with each other, learning how to problem solve, learning how to, you know, communicate with other children, particularly when children don't have the vocal skills yet. They're learning how to communicate through their movements and through, you know, looking at somebody or through different sounds. So there are just so many things that children are developing through play that we don't even notice, and we don't, as adults, we're not really kind of paying attention to. But if you let them go and let them do their thing, they're learning so much.
And I would add that children learn everything through play. It is the way in which a child helps to develop and build their own sense of self, their connection to others, where they are actually able to learn how to think and put themselves in another person's shoes, absolutely critical to becoming a member of society. They learn about conflict and conflict resolution. We have kids with an incredible amount of kids with dysregulation. Kids learn how to regulate their emotions and their bodies through play. Actually, all the research shows, a century worth of research, that children who have a lot of child-initiated free play do better academically throughout their academic lives. They do better socially and emotionally.
How have we gotten away from letting kids do their thing? How did all of this start, this decline of play?
It's a great question. I think some of it our esteemed third guest, Susan Lin, will be able to address. But our culture has changed, and I believe that there are a lot of it, it's very complex, but I believe that a lot of this has to do with becoming a more market-driven, competitive culture.
Okay, well, we will address that in a moment after a short break. But you were talking about how kids learn to negotiate. They learn how to resolve conflicts. But I see a lot of times parents swoop in before a conflict has even started, and they say, oh, no, no, let the other kid have the swing. No, 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 you let... And the kids never get a chance to try. So are we hyperactive as parents in just always making sure our kid is not the bad kid?
Right. I think that, you know, that has a lot to do with it. We tend to want to take our children away from some type of perceived danger. And that could be a bullying situation. That could be, you know, if there's some type of violence involved and the child is hitting another child or something like that. And of course, that should be, I personally think that that should be the point with which an adult steps in when, you know, when there's pushing like that. And that should be it. I think that that's kind of the mark. So I do think that adults and caregivers and parents step in a little too soon and we should kind of let it go and see how it all plays out and see where it goes. Because again, you know, children learn all of these behaviors as children. And then when they become adults, they mimic that behavior. So we need to, in order to raise, you know, correct problem-solving adults, we need to allow children to problem-solve.
I also believe that we need to support our parents more. I believe that we're a culture that does not hold our young families in a supportive way, giving them time with their children.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We're talking about the importance of play with Marjorie Bosk, a clinical child psychologist in private practice in Bryn Mawr, and Naomi Robertson. She is the program director at Smith Memorial Playground. Coming up, we'll be joined by Susan Lin from the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. All that is coming up on Radio Times here on WHYY.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
80 years later, a song about the Roaring Twenties seems absolutely relevant.
You better accept the fact that anything's gonna go, because that's what America's about. You might as well enjoy the ride.
In olden days, a glimpse of stars.
Anything goes. That's our next American icon in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Anything goes.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a restaurant at one end of the mall might fail. Move it to the other end, it'll have a huge success. Now some software companies want access to your social media to figure out where to put that store. That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking about the importance of play in the lives of children and why they should play more. We're here in the studio with clinical child psychologist Marjorie Bosk and also Naomi Robertson, program director at Smith Memorial Playground. And joining us now on the phone is Susan Lin. She is the director and co-founder of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Susan, thank you so much for joining us as well.
So happy to be talking with you.
Susan, your name just came up before our break when I asked, well, how did we get here? How did we lose our way when it comes to play? And they said, well, ask Susan. So let me ask you. What happened?
Well, I think as Marjorie said, it's a complex question. But one of the primary factors in the erosion of children's creative play is the unprecedented convergence of ubiquitous miniaturized screen media and unfettered, unregulated commercialism.
Yes.
That combination is just a disaster for children's creative play.
Mm-hmm. And Susan, let me ask you before we go further into that, what do we know about how little children have this kind of free play we're talking about? What are the actual numbers? What do we know about that?
Marjorie may know more about this than I do. I don't know the actual numbers. I mean, I don't think we have research showing exactly how much children's creative play is declining. What we do have is research showing that children's creativity is declining. And that began in 1990.
And what
we
about
do have
screen
that research.
Time?
And we do know that media linked toys and commercialism actually does erode children's creative play.
And how much time do kids spend looking at screens?
Well, on any given day, on average, 64% of American babies between the ages of 1 and 2 are in front of a screen, television and video, are watching television and videos for an average of over 2 hours a day.
Oh.
That's just babies. Preschool children, the figures kind of vary, but I've seen figures up to 32 hours a week with screens. On any given day, children between the ages of 8 to 18 are spending, on average, over 7.5 hours with screen media. It's a huge amount of time, and what research does tell us is that the more time infants, toddlers, and preschoolers spend with screens, the less time they spend in the activities that are absolutely known, proven to be beneficial to them.
Yeah.
Hands-on creative play, active play, and face time with the adults who care about them.
And Naomi, do you think kids lose the ability? You said earlier, all kids know how to play. Does that ability diminish? Is it thwarted by just sitting around staring at a screen and just reacting? When you play video games, you're reacting to somebody else's plot, essentially.
Right, and then there's already characters involved that you don't have to make up. So I do think, you know, children at times can lose their imaginations and their ability to imagine their own worlds when they are, in front of a screen for almost 7 hours a day. It's astounding.
Marjorie?
As a clinical psychologist and someone who consults with preschools and have been talking through the Philadelphia Declaration of Play with many, many educators, we are all enormously alarmed by children whom we see highly trained but very flattened in their affect, who have lost their spark, their zest. that unbridled enthusiasm and love of learning. We're very frightened about that.
And I recently interviewed an occupational therapist who's been in the field for 25 years, and she said, I'm seeing a lot of children who can't do basic motor skill things,
exactly.
like tying their shoes or moving around. So are you observing that?
Absolutely.
And Susan Lynn, let me return to you. A lot of parents I know make a difference. They say, well, this is a valuable video game. This is a learning game. This is that kind of game. The kids are learning how to spell. How do you feel about that? Is screen time just screen time, no matter if it's smart or not so smart?
Well, first of all, I want to join Marjorie and Naomi in saying that I really do not want to place blame on parents for what's happening in children's lives today. Yes, parents bear some responsibility, but they're really dealing with a commercialized culture that is so pervasive. It's unprecedented. No family in history has ever had to deal with what parents are dealing with today. And also, I think it's never been more stressful to be a parent than it is today. And so parents are working serial jobs. Both parents are working. You know, they're not living near their families anymore. So I think that we really have to, you know, be very careful about laying this completely at the feet of parents. And I also think that when we think about screen time, first of all, we need to think about the age and developmental range of the children. So, for instance, there's no evidence, I mean, really no credible evidence that any kind of screen time can be educational for babies. Babies and toddlers learn kinesthetically. They learn with all of their senses. And screen time really deprives them of those opportunities. As children get older, there is evidence that some screen time can be beneficial to them, but we still have to be concerned about, first of all, the amount of time that they're spending with screen media, and also with what the screen media is selling them. And one of the problems is that most of the media that children engage with today are selling them something. Either they're selling them toys, they're selling them food, or they're selling them more different kinds of media. And so one of the things that's really concerning is that there are very few media experiences for children that aren't selling them something.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a caller, Kristen in Valley Forge, who wants to join us, and she brings up another very important topic. Hi, Kristen, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Hello.
I was calling because I just wanted to bring up the idea of homework and how much homework students get assigned.
Yes.
When I started kindergarten, I went to an all-girls school on the main line, and my mom tells the story of she walked in and saw no toys, no blocks, nothing, and she asked the teacher, oh, you know, is there time to play or is there anything to play with? And the response was, school is not a time for play. The children have enough time to play at home. And that pattern, as I went through school, was just the amount of homework I got. And the excuse is always, this is preparing you for, you know, high school, preparing you for college, preparing you for grad school, that it just was suffocating and there really isn't enough time in a day to play. And I think it's really lacking in so many students is that they're just, you know, so focused on homework and achieving and earning good grades that whole creative play outlet is gone.
Yeah. And Naomi, you're nodding your head. Thank you so much, Kristen, for your call.
Thank you.
Let me give the experts a chance to weigh in on that. Naomi?
Something that she, that Kristen just said kind of hit home, where we are always preparing our children for the next step.
Yes.
As opposed to allowing them to just live in the here and now. So we're not allowing our kids to just live and be. Like, they're always having to prepare for the next thing. And I think that that definitely takes away from their creative creative minds and creative selves. There's a very funny picture that's going around the social media world with some children who are clearly live in some type of tribal environment, and they're talking amongst each other, and they're saying, you know, I heard that in the Western world, children have to sit in seats for 7 hours, and they can't play, and then they go home and they look at screens. We should send them some money and support them, you know. And it further just kind of goes along those lines of children learn through play. And we are not allowing our children to play, thus we're not allowing our children to learn intrinsically.
But Marjorie, what do you do as a parent? You know, you have to get your kid into school, you have to get them through school, they have the homework, so what do you say?
Parents are really in a pickle, but we are the protectors of our children. And while there are enormous pressures for our parents, one of the reasons that the Philadelphia Declaration of Play came together as a coalition of people who care about children, we need to educate parents, and parents need to demand this for their children. This is, in some ways, and I think, Kristen, you bring up just such an important issue. I think this is a real case of the emperor's new clothes. Every single bit of good research that we've had for over a century supports that the more child-initiated free play, the less stress, the better kids do academically throughout their academic careers. Our educators should know this, and we are hoping, as a grassroots organization, to actually be a movement that supports the appropriate developmental expectations for children, for all children.
And Susan Lynn, let me ask you a similar question. Now, all three of you have said, you know, we're not blaming or shaming parents, but what can parents do to fight back against this constant invasion of commercialism into our homes and every aspect of our lives?
One of the reasons that my colleagues and I started the campaign for commercial-free childhood is to give parents an opportunity to come together. One person's voice may not be strong enough. If we all speak out together, then we really can make a difference. I agree with Marjorie that, and as we don't want to blame parents, that we are their protectors, and we do need to speak out for them. And I think that one thing is to try to work within the school to change what's going on in the school, but also the fact that schools are becoming less and less play-based, which is so troubling and is a societal issue, that it becomes even more important for parents to be able to set limits on screen time and commercialism in their homes. It's easier, you know, to do this if you can find other parents who share your values. It's hard to be the only one. But I think that really it's important for us to recognize that this really is a serious problem and that we do need to take a stand about it.
And Susan, you've also written a book about make-believe play. How do you define that, and what's the value? Why do you think it's so important?
Well, creative play is the foundation of learning and creativity, constructive problem solving. It's how children learn to self-regulate, and also it's their experience and the way that they develop a rich inner life. And what we want, I mean, we have to ask ourselves if we want to raise a generation of children who are either bored or anxious if they are, unless they're in front of a screen. And what I think we want is for children to be able to soothe and amuse themselves. And that's what creative play engenders in children.
And any advice for any tips, you know, if you are a parent and you want to make sure that your kids can do this, how do you start?
Well, you start from infancy, and you remember that what children need for creative play is exactly what we're depriving them of. They need time, they need space, including psychological space. They need silence. They need not to be constantly bombarded with sounds and with noise and with stimulation. Boredom is really important for creativity. And one of the things that's so seductive about the new media and is that, you know, when children, you know, start to get bored, they may get a little bit cranky, and that's really hard for parents. But what we need to do is let them sort of get through the crankiness and to find something in the world that interests them, to look around them. And if you watch kids who are sitting and waiting in doctor's offices or in line somewhere, you see them playing. They can't even help themselves. They start to interact with the world, or they make funny noises or funny faces. Or I remember being in a department store and watching a little girl play some kind of hopscotch with the linoleum blocks on the floor, and that kind of generativity is so, I mean, it's so important for creativity. I think it's important for parents to recognize, for all of us to recognize, that the best-selling toys, the toys that look good in commercials, are not really the best toys for children. The best toys for children are 90% child and only 10% toy. The best toys just lie there until somebody picks them up and changes them into something else. The best toys can be used over and over and over again. And so, ironically, the best toys and the toys that will really help children flourish in this media-saturated, commercialized world are the toys that are being dismissed today as sort of old-fashioned and boring.
Like what?
Blocks. Stuffed animals that do not talk by themselves or move or jump or do backflips. Blocks. Art supplies. The toys that, as I said, that just lie there until a child picks them up and either transforms them or uses them to transform the world.
I am laughing because I just threw out a horse, which whinnies, and it drove me crazy. And I threw it out last night and then woke up this morning and realized that this horse, because it got wet, had been whinnying and neighing all night long in my yard. So I apologize. I apologize to all Fairmount residents. But it makes you not sorry, Marjorie.
I wanted to commend you for your bravery and courage, actually. I mean this sincerely, in not caving to the peer pressure that parents are subjected to. And to piggyback on some of the things that Susan said, that this boredom, this silence, if our children cannot figure out what to do that's fun, how are they going to solve societal problems later that are complex?
Good point. And we will be right back after a short break. Susan Lin, thank you so much for joining us. She is the co-founder of the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. Coming up, more with our guests Marjorie Bosk and Naomi Robison. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be right back after a short break here on Radio Times on WHYY.
The Bedminster Traditional Artisan Show supports WHYY and features more than 50 of America's noted traditional artisans with handmade items from fine art to original American folk craft. Highlights of this juried art show include fine period furniture, redware pottery, Windsor chairs, hooked rugs, and paintings, all made in America. Saturday and Sunday, September 21st and 22nd at the Upper Bucks Technical School in Bedminster. Proceeds benefit the Bedminster Regional Land Conservancy, helping to protect and preserve open space in Upper Bucks County. Information at BedminsterTraditionalArtisanShow.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Linda Ronstadt talks about her singing career. She's written a new memoir. Ronstadt recently revealed she has Parkinson's disease and can no longer sing. Join us.
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
History and memory for Iranians whose lives were changed forever after the 1979 revolution.
For many Iranians, they cannot reconcile their memory of their country in this period with the Iran of today.
Art, memory, and the possibility of a new future for the U.S. and Iran. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the importance of play in the lives of children. We'll get to our phone calls in a moment, but our guest, Naomi Robertson from the Smith Memorial Playground, you wanted to weigh in on something Susan Lynn said just before our break.
Yes, and we talk about play and what children need and what types of toys children need. Susan Lynn definitely made good points about, the block play and having things at your house that can be used for play. So one of the big initiatives that we have at Smith is the idea of what's in your toolbox? What's in your toy
yes.
box? Where are all the things
yes.
that you have at home at your disposal
That's
that
right.
you can use? And I think that it's particularly important that we talk about that subject with populations who may not have the disposable income to buy a lot of toys, but who feel like they have to buy toys in order for their children to play. So, a simple bed sheet means a lot to a kid.
Absolutely.
Blocks, Lincoln Logs, things that you can use.
Stones,
rocks.
Pots and pans.
Pots
yes.
and pans.
Tupperware container.
Exactly. The greatest, one of the, an awesome picture that I have of my nephew. He'll probably really hurt me if he hears this. I have a picture of him as a child. He is now going to be 16 very soon, but I have a picture of him when he was about less than a year playing with pots and pans, and he has the biggest smile on his face that you could ever imagine a little baby having. And I think that just hits home the notion of you have things in your house
yes.
that children can play with.
Let's go to the phones. We have Danielle joining us from Roxborough. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Sure, go ahead.
I just wanted to make a couple of comments. The first is that I'm a speech therapist. I work in Philadelphia with the birth to five population. And you had commented earlier about kids losing their play skills. And it's interesting because I am seeing a lot of that. And it's unfortunate. And I think it's closely related to also their development of speech and language.
Yes.
Is talking through, during pretend play activities. Talking about where a person is going in the house or like a playhouse or something along those lines. So I am seeing, again, quite a bit going on. And actually my kids on the spectrum, with autism or Asperger's are actually having better play skills than some of my other children that I work with. So,
So you are seeing, Danielle, you're saying you are seeing a decline in speech abilities and also in play abilities.
Yes.
Okay.
I think that they are very closely related to one another.
Yeah. Danielle, thank you so much. Let me have Marjorie weigh in on that. I mean, I guess it makes sense if you don't talk much because you're looking at a screen all day, you don't talk much.
Absolutely. And what we know from our best literacy research and best practices is that what really helps children to read and to be lovers of learning is the ability to create stories themselves. And that's where real literacy begins, to be talked to by parents and to make up their own stories. So, Danielle, I love the work you're doing, and I'm saddened, but I also see what you're seeing.
Let's get Maya on the phone. Hi, Maya. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call and for having this topic on this morning. I wanted to bring to the dialogue the concept of play in nature. There's
yes.
a wonderful book called Last Child in the Woods that
yes.
talks about how vitally important it is for children to have access to nature, to play in nature for all elements of their development. And nature can be a forest. Or it can just be a tree or a plant in an urban community. The book stresses that very much. And I just wanted to say when it comes to the homework, if I have a 7-year-old, and if he says to me, hey, Mom, I want to go play outside, in the garden, but he has homework to do, I will tell him to go play in the garden and to forget his homework, and then I'll write a note to the teacher and let her know that I did that, because I think play in nature is so vitally important from my own experience, but also from reading this book. And I was just wondering, you know, what your guest had to say about the importance of access to nature for children.
All right. Thank you so much, Maya, for the call. What's your take? Naomi, let's start with you.
I think that it's nature and play is extremely important. Again, there are so many things that you can play with in nature. It's just so fun. And I think particularly in Philadelphia, just kind of as a when we think about city structures and the landscape of the city and the fact that there are so many vacant lots and vacant land in the city, we have so much disposable land that could be used as nature play for the children in those specific neighborhoods. And I think that that's extremely important. I also think that one person writing a letter to their child's teacher about, you know, he has too much homework, I let him go out and play. I think that that is the first step in the advocacy of play. One person can do that. And as an organizing organization, the Philadelphia Declaration of Play encourages that. We want parents and caregivers and protectors of play and protectors of children to understand that we need to gather together and protect our children and protect their right to play.
Maya, I couldn't agree with you more. I think play in nature is time in nature is actually synonymous with play. It's how we come to know so much, but we get connected to the world. And how can we possibly expect our children to become stewards of the environment if they have no, you know, early connection to it? So keep writing those letters, talk to your teachers, and get your friends and relatives to do the same.
Naomi?
If you've ever been to Smith Memorial Playground and Playhouse before, you know that while we have a lot of play equipment, we also are surrounded by East Fairmont Park. So a lot, sometimes you'll see kids who may not be who aren't that familiar with nature kind of reel back and say, oh, this is dirty, I don't want to get dirty. But then as they are rolling down the hills, they get a little more familiar with it and they see that it's fun. So I think a lot of times children who are not used to being in nature need it even more. They need to understand that connection.
Absolutely.
With the natural environment.
And Naomi, let me ask you, you mentioned the role of communities. You mentioned, oh, we have all these vacant lots that could be turned into places where kids can play. Is that happening? For example, in Philadelphia this summer, we had the Oval turned into a place where kids could play, and kids did play.
Yes.
So are you seeing that happening? Do you see communities buy into this concept?
Definitely, especially with, I live in the Brewerytown neighborhood, so that's kind of north of Fairmount. So we have a lot of vacant land. So it's about a block getting together and advocating to their city council person about, we need this lot. You know, right now there's nothing being done with it. So we would like to use it as a community garden or just a community safe space. I think that that's extremely important. And we are seeing a lot of that. There are organizations in Philadelphia like the Public Workshop who are doing wonderful things with vacant land use and ways to kind of transform it into play spaces. And so I think that that's, you know, the tide is changing around the vacant lot issue.
And I guess the issue of childhood obesity has brought some of this really to a head, at
yes.
least the need for spaces to move.
Definitely. Smith Memorial Playground is in the Strawberry Mansion neighborhood, which has a very high high percentage of childhood obesity. And we also know that childhood obesity directly correlates with socioeconomic background. So a lot of our poor neighborhoods have very high incidences of obesity. And we, as the Philadelphia Declaration of Play and as Smith Memorial Playground, we really want to advocate that play is the answer, one of the answers to childhood obesity.
Let's take another call. We have Bill joining us from Belmont Hills. Hi, Bill. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I agree with what everybody's saying, and I certainly know that Smith Playground is a great resource. Our child has gone there a lot, and many low-income kids go there too. But I think in the big picture, a lot of this talk and a lot of this focus on screen time is minor, because there's a big class division. Kids in the inner city aren't able to play outside. They're inside for a number of reasons. The parents work a lot. The streets might be unsafe. The parents may not be educated enough or have enough emphasis on creativity. They may not have gotten that themselves. There are just so many problems, whereas all those things are reversed here in the suburbs where I live and where my kids go to school. And the big ace in the hole are the schools. As we know, Philadelphia schools are in major crisis. There's not a lot of emphasis on creativity, probably even less now that the arts have been cut from schools. And so against that context, hey, keep doing what you're doing. But I think it's really a very tiny, tiny part of the picture, I think, in terms of outcomes.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, I do wonder, though, we have talked earlier, I mean, the kind of screen time, the pressure, we see that across the board. I think, so Marjorie, go ahead.
I was going to speak to that issue. I agree, Bill, generally, that having money always is better than not, and certainly for children and families for a myriad of reasons. And I didn't mean that to be snarky in any way. I mean it from the bottom of my heart. But one of the reasons that the Philadelphia Declaration of Play got together is that this is an epidemic and a mental, physical health crisis that is affecting not only our poorest and most vulnerable children, but all children. Children in our upper classes are obese too, and there's too much screen time. While they may be having a bit less screen time in their after-school lives, what it is replaced with is highly, highly, highly structured, pressured, adult-directed and driven athletics, art and music classes. And this we are finding, while it gives skills, it also depresses and dampens the spirit of the child, him or herself. So it's across the board that we're talking about.
Naomi, let me have you weigh in on this.
Yes, and what Bill said about adults possibly not playing. I think that we, in our workshops that we do with parent groups, we talk a lot about the play-deprived adult and adults who may not have played as children, so they don't know how to, you know, interact with their children around play. Marjorie and I, about a year ago, did a workshop with an organization, and we asked the adults about their memories of play. And we had one adult that said, "I never played as a child because I was a foster child and I could not play. I had to take care of all of my younger siblings." And that's a very, very important just notion and concept, that there are adults that never played. And if they've never played, then they can't then, you know, be good stewards of their children's play.
And hence how urgent this issue is now. And to that point, or one of your points, Naomi, we are actually, as are other groups around the country, but the Philadelphia Declaration of Play is creating an archive of play memories. And at our conference, Bringing Back Childhood for the Future of Society, we will be having a North Philadelphia group, the UCC, who will be recording and then creating a documentary of play memories among the attendees and the presenters. We find that wherever we go, when we ask parents, adults, educators, to step back for a moment and think about their own important play memories, as you asked us in the beginning of the show, Mike, and what we find is that people relax, they begin to smile, some parents burst into tears, and that is where, in their play memories, they are really connecting with an important part of themselves. And that is the connection that we hope that they, that our event will help parents and educators and others to be able to hold on to why play is so important when they look inside themselves.
And we're coming up against the clock, but what are some of the goals for the Declaration of Play, for the conference? What do you want to achieve over the next couple of years?
This conference is almost the first step in our grassroots movement and advocacy around play. Marjorie can speak more about the Declaration of Play and the creation of the Declaration of Play. But I think that this conference is really kind of just the first step in our big movement around being good play stewards and stewards of play.
It's about really encouraging the choir and people not in the choir in terms of the importance of play to come together to see how many other adult professionals, people who care about children, people who were children once themselves, to come together. We are hoping through this weekend to actually have our attendees begin to help direct the directions in which we go. We want a stronger collective voice.
And are you getting good feedback from parents? Does this resonate with them?
So much. So much. They're asking. It's like fire alighting, you know, that educators, parents, pediatricians are saying, yes, let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Naomi.
It's been people from different disciplines. You know, as Marjorie just said, we're having educators and we have psychologists, but we also have landscape architects who
yes.
are interested in how playgrounds are built and what are the best ways to build playgrounds to kind of to make sure that children are playing and playing, you know, not correctly, but because there is no correct way to play.
Yes.
creatively.
You know, so we're seeing a lot of different disciplines
coming together around the issue
yes.
of play. And with that, we're going to have to close. We were joined by Naomi Robertson. She's the program director at Smith Memorial Playground and Playhouse in Philadelphia's Fairmount Park. We are also joined by Marjorie Bosk. She is a clinical child psychologist in private practice in Bryn Mawr. Thank you both so much for joining us
on
Radio Times.
Thank you.
And we were talking, and there is a lot more information online, of course, about the Declaration of Play and about the upcoming conference. We'll post that on our website. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moscowane, and you've been listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.